Cock Robin had ceased to subsist solely on worms, and ate rice, corn, lettuce, and nasturtium seeds. He had grown to be a huge size. The big robin at Ingleside was becoming locally famous, and his breast had turned to a beautiful red. He would perch on Susan's shoulder and watch her knit. He would fly to meet Anne when she returned after an absence, and hop before her into the house. He came to Walter's windowsill every morning for crumbs. He took his daily bath in a basin in the backyard, in the corner of the sweetbriar hedge, and would raise the most unholy fuss if he found no water in it. The doctor complained that his pens and matches were always strewn all over the library, but found nobody to sympathize with him, and even he surrendered when Cock Robin lit fearlessly on his hand one day to pick up a flower seed. Everybody was bewitched by Cock Robin, except perhaps Jem, who had set his heart on Bruno, and was slowly but all too surely learning a bitter lesson, that you can buy a dog's body, but you cannot buy his love. At first, Jem never suspected this. Of course, Bruno would be a bit homesick and lonesome for a time, but that would soon wear off. Jem found it did not. Bruno was the most obedient little dog in the world. He did exactly what he was told, and even Susan admitted that a better behaved animal couldn't be found. But there was no life in him. When Jem took him out, Bruno's eyes would gleam alertly at first, his tail would wag, and he would start off cockily. But after a little while, the glow would leave his eyes, and he would trot meekly beside Jem with drooping crest. Kindness was showered upon him by all. The juiciest and meatiest of bones were at his disposal. Not the slightest objection was made to his sleeping at the foot of Jem's bed every night, but Bruno remained remote, inaccessible, a stranger. Sometimes in the night, Jem woke and reached down to pat the sturdy little body, but there was never any answering lick of tongue or thump of tail. Bruno permitted caresses, but he would not respond to them. Jem set his teeth. There was a good bit of determination in James Matthew Blythe, and he was not going to be beaten by a dog. His dog, whom he had bought fairly and squarely with money hardly saved from his allowance. Bruno would just have to get over being homesick for Roddy, have to give up looking at you with the pathetic eyes of a lost creature, have to learn to love him. Jem had to stand up for Bruno, for the other boys in school, suspecting how he loved the dog, were always trying to pick on him. "Your dog has fleas, great big fleas," taunted Perry Reese. Jem had to trounce him before Perry would take it back and say Bruno hadn't a single flea, not one. "My pup takes fits once a week," boasted Bob Russell. "I'll bet your old pup never had a fit in his life. If I had a dog like that, I'd run him through the meat grinder." "We had a dog like that once," said Mike Drew, "but we drowned him." "My dog's an awful dog," said Sam Warren proudly. "He kills the chickens and chews up all the clothes on wash day. Bet your old dog hasn't spunk enough for that." Jem sorrowfully admitted to himself, if not to Sam, that Bruno hadn't. He almost wished he had. And it stung when Waddy Flagg shouted, "Your dog's a good dog. He never barks on Sunday," because Bruno didn't bark any day. But with it all, he was such a dear, adorable little dog. "Bruno, why won't you love me?" almost sobbed Jem. "There's nothing I wouldn't do for you. We could have such fun together." But he would not admit defeat to anyone. Jem hurried home one evening from a mussel bake at the harbor mouth because he knew a storm was coming. The sea moaned so. Things had a sinister, lonely look. There was a long rip and tear of thunder as Jem dashed into Ingleside. "Where's Bruno?" he shouted. It was the first time he had gone anywhere without Bruno. He had thought the long walk to the harbor mouth would be too much for a little dog. Jem would not admit to himself that such a long walk with a dog whose heart was not in it would be a little too much for him as well. It developed that nobody knew where Bruno was. He had not been seen since Jem left after supper. Jem hunted everywhere, but he was not to be found. The rain was coming down in floods. The world was drowned in lightning. Was Bruno out in that black night? Lost? Bruno was afraid of thunderstorms. The only times he had ever seemed to come near Jem in spirit was when he crept close to him while the sky was riven asunder. Jim worried so that when the storm was spent, Gilbert said, "I ought to go up to the head anyway to see how Roy Westcott is getting on. You can come too, Jim, and we'll drive around by the old Crawford place on our way home. I have an idea Bruno has gone back there."
6 miles? He'd never, said Jim.
But he had. When they got to the old, deserted, lightless Crawford house, a shivering, bedraggled little creature was huddled forlornly on the wet doorstep, looking at them with tired, unsatisfied eyes. He made no objection when Jim gathered him up in his arms and carried him out to the buggy through the knee-high, tangled grass. Jim was happy. How the moon was rushing through the sky as the clouds tore past her. How delicious were the smells of the rain-wet woods as they drove along. What a world it was. "I guess Bruno will be contented at Ingleside after this, Dad."
"Perhaps," was all Dad said. He hated to throw cold water, but he suspected that a little dog's heart, losing its last home, was finally broken.
Bruno had never eaten very much, but after that night, he ate less and less. Came a day when he would not eat at all. The vet was sent for, but could find nothing wrong.
"I knew one dog in my experience who died of grief, and I think this is another," he told the doctor aside.
He left a tonic, which Bruno took obediently, and then lay down again, his head on his paws, staring into vacancy. Jim stood looking at him for a long while, his hands in his pockets. Then he went into the library to have a talk with Dad. Gilbert went to town the next day, made some inquiries, and brought Roddy Crawford out to Ingleside. When Roddy came up the veranda steps, Bruno, hearing his footfall from the living room, lifted his head and cocked his ears. The next moment, his emaciated little body hurled itself across the rug towards the pale, brown-eyed lad. "Mrs. Doctor, dear," Susan said in an awed tone that night. "The dog was crying. He was. The tears actually rolled down his nose. I do not blame you if you do not believe it. Never would I have believed it if I had not seen it with my own eyes." Roddy held Bruno against his heart and looked half defiantly, half pleadingly at Jim.
"You bought him, I know, but he belongs to me. Jake told me a lie. Aunt Vinnie says she wouldn't mind a dog a bit, but I thought I mustn't ask for him back. Here's your dollar. I never spent a cent of it. I couldn't."
For just a moment, Jim hesitated. Then he saw Bruno's eyes. "What a little pig I am," he thought in disgust with himself. He took the dollar. Roddy suddenly smiled. The smile changed his sulky face completely, but all he could say was a gruff, "Thanks." When Roddy brought him food, Bruno ate it eagerly, keeping an eye on Roddy all the time. He pranced friskily after Jim and Roddy when they went down to the glen. "Such a perked-up dog you never saw," declared Susan. But the next evening, after Roddy and Bruno had gone back, Jem sat on the side door steps in the owl light for a long time. He refused to go digging for pirate hordes in Rainbow Valley with Walter. Jem felt no longer splendidly bold and buccaneering. He wouldn't even look at the shrimp who was humped in the mint, lashing his tail like a fierce mountain lion crouching to spring. What business had cats to go on being happy at Ingleside when dogs broke their hearts? He was even grumpy with Rilla when she brought him her blue velvet elephant. Velvet elephants when Bruno had gone. Nan got us short shrift when she came and suggested they should say what they thought of God in a whisper.
"You don't suppose I'm blaming God for this?" said Jim sternly. "You haven't any sense of proportion, Nan Blythe."
Nan went away quite crushed, though she hadn't the least glimmering what Jim meant, and Jim scowled at the embers of the smoldering sunset. Dogs were barking all over the glen. The Jenkins down the road were out calling theirs. All of them took turns at it. Everyone, even the Jenkins tribe, could have a dog. Everyone but him. Life stretched before him like a desert, where there could be no dogs. Anne came and sat down on a lower step, carefully not looking at him. Jim felt her sympathy.
"Motherest," he said in a choked voice, "why wouldn't Bruno love me when I loved him so much? Am I? Do you think I am the kind of boy dogs don't like?" No, darling. Remember how Jip loved you. It was just that Bruno had only so much love to give, and he had given it all. There are dogs like that, one-man dogs. Anyhow, Bruno and Roddy are happy, said Jim with grim satisfaction as he bent over and kissed the top of Mother's smooth, ripply head. But I'll never have another dog. Anne thought this would pass. He had felt the same when Jippy died. But it did not. The iron had bitten deeply into Jem's soul. Dogs were to come and go at Ingleside. Dogs that belonged just to the family and were nice dogs, whom Jem petted and played with as the others did. But there was to be no Jem's dog, until a certain little dog Monday was to take possession of his heart and love him with a devotion passing Bruno's love, a devotion that was to make history in the Glen. But that was still many a long year away, and a very lonely boy climbed into Jem's bed that night. I wish I was a girl, he thought fiercely, so's I could cry and cry.